Hello and welcome to this episode of Epochs, where after a two-week hiatus, I shall be continuing my story all about the decline and fall of the Roman Republic. Thank you for staying with me. Hopefully you're looking forward to continuing this story as much as I am. Last time, I left off talking about Caesar, didn't I? If you remember, I'm doing the narrative intertwined with Pompey and Caesar, but where Pompey's life, or career, both actually, starts before Caesar's. Did a couple of episodes on him and his earlier career, and an episode on Caesar's earlier life and career. So hopefully in this episode, or halfway through, or towards the end of this episode, their lives and careers will start to properly intertwine. If you remember, I left off Pompey, where he had defeated the pirates, that point in his career. And I'd left off Caesar. I was just about to start talking about the great goddess scandal, the Bonadia affair, whatever you want to call it. And I should be continuing using Plutarch as the main source. But very soon, during this episode, I would have thought, Appian starts picking up his narrative, really where Pompey and Caesar's careers really start overlapping. So we won't just be using Plutarch very soon. We'll also have Appian. And then going forward, also, I should be using Cassius Dio. And then also probably from the next episode onwards, or at some point, I'll start using third-party sources as well. Modern sources, modern historians, what they've got to say about these things. But for now, we're just going to continue using Plutarch. Okay, let's continue then. If you remember, I had said, or Plutarch had told us, that just explicitly, Caesar's wife, Poppaea, and Clodius Pulcher, were lovers. And that Caesar's mother, Aurelia, sort of tried to not let Poppaea out of her sight. So it's very difficult for Clodius and Poppaea to hook up. But yet, nonetheless, that didn't really stop Pulcher, or Clodius. Let's call him Clodius. Okay, so Plutarch says this, quote, "The Romans have a goddess whom they call the good goddess, the same one as the Greeks call the woman's goddess. The Phrygians claim this goddess as their own and say that she was the mother of King Midas. The Romans say that she was one of the nymphs called Dryads and was married to Phanus. The Greeks say that she is that one of the mothers of Dionysus, whose name must not be spoken. And this is why the women, when they are celebrating her festival, cover the tents with branches of vine and, in accordance with the myth, have a sacred snake enthroned at the goddess's side. It is not lawful for a man to be present at the rites, nor even to be in the house where they are being celebrated. The women perform these sacred ceremonies by themselves, and these ceremonies are said to be very much like those of the Orphics. When the time for the festival comes, the consul or praetor at whose house it is being held goes away." In this instance, it was the Pontifex Maximus, i.e. Caesar himself. "As does every male creature in the household. His wife then takes over the house and arranges the decorations. The most important ceremonies take place at night. The women play together among themselves during the night-long celebrations, and there is much music as well. On this occasion, when Poppaea was in charge of the celebrations, Clodius, who was still beardless and therefore thought that he would escape notice, dressed himself up as a female flute player and, looking just like a young woman, arrived at the house. He found the door open and was brought inside quite safely by the maid on duty, who was in on the secret." She's an important person in this affair. She was obviously completely facilitating the quote-unquote affair that Clodius and Poppaea may or may not have been having. He goes on, "The maid then ran off to tell Poppaea. Time passed, and Clodius lacked the patience to stay where he had been left. He began to wander about the house," not a good idea, "which was a very large one, trying to avoid the lights, and was accosted by one of Aurelia's servants, who, as one woman to another, asked him to come and play with her. When Clodius said no, she dragged him forward and asked him who he was and where he came from. Clodius said that he was waiting for Poppaea's girl, Abra, the name of the maid who had introduced him. But his voice gave him away. Aurelia's servant shrieked and ran off to where the lights and the crowd were, crying out that she had caught a man. The women were in a panic. Aurelia put a stop to the sacred rites of the goddess and covered up the holy things, you know, lest the gaze of a man fall upon them. She then ordered the doors to be shut and went all over the house with lighted torches in search of Clodius. He was found hiding in the room belonging to the maid who had let him into the house, and when it was discovered who he was, the women drove him out of doors. They then went away immediately while it was still night and told their husbands what had happened. As soon as it was day, then word was going about the city that Clodius had committed sacrilege and owed satisfaction not only to those whom he had outraged by his conduct, but also to the city and to the gods. One of the tribunes, therefore, officially indicted Clodius for sacrilege, and the most influential members of the Senate banded themselves together against him. So, unquote. So Clodius was unpopular. Remember, he's already, even though still quite young, i.e. beardless, he was a famous Claudian. He was already known. He was already a political player. And he was already very much disliked for all sorts of reasons. Lots of people would have disliked or been suspicious or jealous of the Claudians anyway. But remember, Clodius was a popularis. He was one of, if not the leading light in the popularis. It was him and Caesar that were really the leading guys in the whole popularis faction. So he's kind of hated already from multiple angles. So once now he's been outed in a proper, true scandal, really having broken laws, almost certainly, probably, although that's still up for some debate, but certainly having left himself open to some very, very serious criticisms, let's say that, his enemies, political enemies in the Senate, sort of smell blood, and as we're told there, banned against him. So, you know, sort of immediately, this is our chance to sort of ruin him, ruin his name, maybe even get him exiled, maybe executed, but, you know, let's see what we can do first. Let's certainly band together against him. There's blood in the water. They, Clodius's political enemies, gave evidence of a number of shocking crimes which he had committed. So they're, you know, bringing out all the dirty stories against him that he'd so far avoided any sort of prosecution for. They're bringing them all up. Among which was adultery with his sister. Well, what? If you remember, I think it was in the Cato episode. I talked about that. There was rumours that Clodius might have been sleeping with one of his sisters. He had two, or was it even three sisters? There's the Clodia sisters. I think there's three of them, and they themselves are very, very popular and unpopular. Right, among the popularis factions, they're darlings. They're it girls, they're trendsetters. But among the conservative faction of the city, they're deeply unpopular. They're thought of as strumpets or something. They're the worst. They're dirty. You know what it's like. You know how popular opinion can be very, very divided on people. I think of somebody like maybe Madonna or Lady Gaga. Some people love them and idolise them, and some people think they're disgusting whores. maybe I'll cut that out. Is that a bit much? Plutarch goes on. He may have committed adultery with his sister, who was the wife of Lucullus. Another quick word, if I can interrupt again, about Lucullus. If you don't remember, I had mentioned that Lucullus was, again, a very important person. He won't get his own epochs or anything, but he's in and around the story loads. He's probably arguably the second most important general in the Republic at this point. Pompey is easily the most important, preeminent imperator, general. But Lucullus is sort of just below him. He'd been out in the east fighting against Mithridates, fighting against the pirates, doing all sorts of things. He's a tried and tested, a sure pair of hands, militarily speaking. And he's older, a bit older than Clodius, generation older. He'd married into the Claudian family, the most preeminent family. So he's Pulcher's brother-in-law. And he'd actually come back from the east not too long before this and spread the rumour around that his wife, that he was obviously sort of no longer in love with, was sleeping with her own brother, Clodius, this Clodius. So all sorts of scandals going on, and it's all being brought up now. Maybe we can get Clodius. You know, no one can be this brazen and get away with it forever. You know, who does he think he is? Bill Cosby? Jimmy Savile? P. Diddy? Can't get away with it forever, usually. Well, Savile did, didn't he? Anyway, that's a side note. Plutarch goes on. The people, however, set themselves against this party of the nobility, and their defence of Clodius was very useful to him, so far as the jury were concerned, who took alarm and were terrified at the numbers of his supporters. So Plutarch, has just moved the story along there. Like, the ancient historians do that a lot. If you're not very careful, you know, days or weeks have passed there, and now suddenly he's just one sentence later, not even a paragraph break, just one sentence later, he's talking about a whole new scene. So this is the trial, in inverted commas, of Clodius. It's not even really a trial. It's the Senate having a hearing to decide whether there should be a full trial. But nonetheless, there's a jury of a type. And Clodius's supporters, the Popularis faction, the goateed young ones, the loosely belted fashionable set, have sort of packed the assembly, you know, to intimidate everyone there, to try and get Clodius off. Remember, Cicero wrote about it, saying that they the goateed young ones, these Popularis, little Miss Curio's set, Curio's one of the other leading lights in the Popularis faction, they'd sort of taken control of the gangways. So, you know, real physical, immediate, personal intimidation. Now, the implication is, if Clodius isn't acquitted or let off, then they might go mad, start smashing the place up, burning things down, clubbing people to death. Who knows, right? Just because they're fashionistas doesn't mean they're not an extremely violent mob as well. Plutarch goes on, Caesar divorced Pompeia at once. But when he was called as a witness at the trial, he said that he knew nothing about the charges against Clodius. Because again, remember, Caesar and Clodius are in the same faction, right? The Popularis faction. So although Clodius has almost certainly done him dirty on some level here, one, perhaps having an affair with his wife, and two, just making him look bad, three, making the whole faction look bad, still, it's not in Caesar's interest to completely throw him under the bus. That would divide the faction. Also, Clodius is a powerful person in a few different ways. His family name, his rich, and his sway among the Popularis, his sheer popularity in the city. You know, it's not really an enemy you want. It's not an enemy Caesar particularly would want. So Caesar is very, very reluctant to just throw Clodius under the bus, to just give some sort of witness statement completely condemning him. That's not going to be a good look for Caesar. So he sort of plays his cards very close to his chest. Caesar said he knew nothing about the charges against Clodius. This seemed a most surprising thing to say. And the prosecuting counsel asked, in that case, why did you divorce your wife? If you know nothing about it, Caesar, why would you divorce your wife? You know, what's the problem? Because, said Caesar, I considered that my wife ought not to be even suspected. There are various translations of that. Caesar's wife must be above suspicion or beyond reproach. There's all sorts of different translations. This particular Penguin classic is Rex Warner, if you're interested in that sort of thing. Plutarch goes on. Some say that in giving this evidence, Caesar really meant what he said. According to others, he was acting in order to please the people who were determined to save Clodius. At any rate, Clodius was acquitted of the charge. Most of the jurymen handed in their votes in illegible writing so that they might avoid the risks both of violence from the people if they condemned him and of contempt from the nobility if they acquitted him. So, end quote. So there you can see the jury are absolutely intimidated. I mean, it's pretty clear to me that they find themselves stuck between a rock and a hard place and aren't comfortable, to say the very least. So Clodius gets away with it, basically. Very, very annoying. Keep getting away, keep going to court, standing trial, and getting away with it. Okay, so that's the Bonadia scandal. Now we move on to Caesar's, his career proper, if you like, when he becomes a praetor and an imperator and a governor and consul and so on. So we're really getting into the meat of things now. Plutarch goes on, quote, directly after his praetorship, Caesar received Spain as his province. However, he found it very difficult to arrange matters with his creditors, who tried to prevent him leaving the city and were extremely importunate. You know, they say, you owe us loads of money, Gaius Julius Caesar. We're not just going to let you go to Spain for a few years. We need money now. Again, the implication is, otherwise, something terrible is going to happen to you. Nice kneecaps you've got there, Caesar. It'll be a shame if anything happened to them. Sort of a thing. Plutarch says, he, Caesar, therefore turned for help to Crassus, who was the richest man in Rome and who needed Caesar's vigour and fire for carrying out his own political campaign against Pompey. Crassus met the demands of those creditors who were most difficult to deal with and who would not be put off any longer, and gave his personal guarantee for 830 talents so Caesar was able to set out for his province, end quote. 830 talents is loads of money, tons of money. It would be millions of pounds or dollars in modern money. It's really a huge amount. But there, now you can see that already there's this three-way power balancing thing between Pompey and Crassus and Caesar. It sort of already started, or it really starts there, really. Or it would have started at a lower level already, but now it's sort of really a thing. Crassus and Pompey, if you remember from the Crassus episodes, are already, maybe they don't necessarily hate each other's guts yet, but they're absolutely rivals. Caesar's still the new kid on the block. You know, he's an important person, quickly becoming much, much more important, but still he's the least powerful of the three. At this point, at this exact point in Roman political history, Crassus is the older man. He's the richest man. His eloquence as an orator in the Senate is unsurpassed, other than perhaps by Cicero and Cato. But he's a much, much better orator and senator and politician than Pompey. But Pompey is the hero. He is the greatest military man by far. He's literally a hero among men, a living legend, right? So Cicero and Cato and Caesar are important, but the two biggest fish are easily Crassus and Pompey. And they've shared consulships and not been able to get anything done. So we're not too far from now, a few years down the line, their enmity towards each other becomes massive, really sort of starts ripping the Republic apart. At this point, still, they're just sort of playing underhand games against each other, and just playing political games still, trying to undermine each other, being catty against each other, undermining each other's position, doing all that sort of thing before it turns into full-blown civil strife or mob warfare or anything like that. Before any sort of triumvirate is needed to try and prevent that sort of thing, they're still just kind of at each other's throats. Now, Crassus obviously makes the calculation, or is making the ongoing calculation, that if he can get as much support from as many places as possible into his camp, so to speak, then he's obviously denying Pompey that. So Crassus sees Caesar as an up-and-coming, correctly, as an up-and-coming power. You know, Caesar probably will be a big beast at some point, or kind of already is, right? He's going to be one of the most important men in Rome. I mean, he's already in the top dozen or so, but he's going to be in the top half dozen. He's going to be in the top three or four or five. So Crassus is already thinking, you know, I'll make him my boy. I'll make him in debt, literally, in money terms, to me, and also in my debt politically. And he'll be in my camp and not Pompey's. You know, Crassus is an astute politician and Pompey isn't. Pompey, I mean, the extent to which Pompey is naive, people always argue about. I happen to think he is quite naive. And we'll get into that further as the story goes on. The extent to which Pompey is naive politically. So because the thing is, sometimes Pompey isn't naive. Sometimes he comes across as he does know what's going on. And he is obviously playing some sort of 3D chess and he isn't a complete chump. But then other times, later, further down the road, after he's done something quite cynical and creative and smart, you know, shown himself that he's capable of political machinations and realpolitik and all that sort of thing, after that he then does something or then shows that he must have been very, very, very naive. He wasn't seeing all the angles. So it's you know, you can argue, definitely argue all about the extent to which Pompey is naive, but on the whole, by and large, I am in the camp that Pompey usually is quite naive, but we'll get to that. I'll let Plutarch continue the story here about Caesar going to Spain. He says, quote, "There is a story that while he was crossing the Alps," this is Caesar crossing the Alps into Transalpine Gaul on his way to Spain, "he came to a small native village with hardly any inhabitants, and altogether a miserable-looking place. His friends were laughing and joking about it, saying, "No doubt here too one would find people pushing themselves forward to gain office, and here too there are struggles to get the first place and jealous rivalries among the great men." Caesar then said to them in all seriousness, "As far as I am concerned, I would rather be the first man here than second in Rome," end quote. It's an interesting little anecdote. There is that classic thing, isn't there? Would you rather be a big fish in a small pond or a small fish in a big pond? Some people, some men, would answer, "I'd rather be a big fish in a small pond because I can't stand having anyone above me. I would rather be of less importance overall if it meant I get to be top dog." It speaks of an ego, doesn't it? It speaks of an ambition unbridled. You know, would you rather be Riker, second in command on the Enterprise, or captain of a much, much lesser starship? I've always thought that I'd rather be a smaller fish, slightly smaller fish in a bigger pond. I want to play at the biggest table, right? I want to be involved in the biggest game, even if it means I don't necessarily get to be at the tippy top of the mountain. But that's just me. It really is a personal preference. But it does usually speak when people insist on being the biggest fish in a small pond. It's usually because they sort of can't stand having not even anyone above them, but even any rivals equal with them. Yeah, I mean, I tend to think that's because you've got a chip on your shoulder about something or other. I don't know. I don't want to do too much armchair psychology stuff there. But that's what Plutarch tells us Caesar said. It does sort of ring true. It's almost too perfect of an anecdote, isn't it? That's exactly the sort of thing where modern scholars say, was that made up after? Is Plutarch or somebody adding that in after, because it's a bit perfect? Because even when Caesar was right at the top of the Roman political game of power, you know, he had to share power with a couple of others, Crassus and Pompey, and he couldn't really stand it in the end. Well, neither could Pompey, though. It's not uncommon. It's not uncommon, is it? A power-sharing settlement of whatever description doesn't always hold together, usually doesn't hold together, because someone's ego can't deal with it.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.